Almost 20 months to the day that the names Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman became headlines and fodder for cable news networks, about 100 people gathered last night on the University of Arkansas campus to hear a panel discussion about the case, the trial, and the subsequent national discussions about the justice system, media, and race.
We're going to have a discussion about the Trayvon Martin case, and as you all know, it was one which really touched every corner of this country. And it really was one that also polarized this nation in many ways, or at least exposed the polarization that exists.
Charles Robinson, Vice Chancellor for Diversity and Community at the University of Arkansas, served as the moderator for the program, sponsored by the U of A's Center for Multicultural and Diversity Education. Five panel members offered analysis of the legal proceedings and how the press, especially cable television, covered the case. It was on February 26, 2012, when George Zimmerman fatally shot Trayvon Martin, an act Zimmerman said was in self-defense. Leon Jones, a criminal defense attorney, was one of last night's panelists. He told the audience the case, stripped of all sensational elements, was still an interesting matter to see unfold.
I think the thing that most intrigued me was the fact that we're not talking about celebrities. We're not talking about people with hundreds of millions of dollars. We're not talking about people that we see and read in the newspaper every day. We're talking about ordinary citizens who had a chance encounter one evening. And that's the thing that really intrigued me about this case. And I tried to pay attention to this case for that very reason. Not necessarily the black-white issue, but just the issue of these two individuals, citizens of the same community, when the facts came out, had a chance encounter. One of them ended up dead, and the other one ended up acquitted. And how did that happen?
Laurent Sakharov, an assistant professor of law at the university who specializes in criminal law and has worked as a defense attorney, used a few moments of last night's discussion to explain why many defense attorneys felt frustration with the trial that played out in front of a national audience.
The frustration of this case for a lot of defense lawyers, including me, is that defense lawyers, and especially public defenders, see firsthand the extraordinary racial bias in the criminal justice system, both how the police profile people, and then once people are arrested and charged. At every level, there are so many studies that show that there's a bias against black people as compared to white people. And what frustrates me about this case is that this case might not actually be the best example of that. And even though it's become a rallying cry, it becomes frustrating because it's hard to pinpoint well the racial bias.
Sakharov says there are many other places to see much clearer examples of racial bias, including litigation in New York City challenging the stop and frisk policy of the police there. He says a federal judge found clear racial bias after studying more than 4 million stop and frisk incidents during an 8-year period. Sakharov says a reading of that case offers what he calls concrete information about racial bias.
And again, going back to my frustration with the Zimmerman case, it really is a lot less clear that he really was. I mean, we have this preconception that he was racially profiling, but when you look at the 46 calls that he had made to the police before that, he calls in a lot of white people, and it's really hard to show there clearly that there was racial profiling in the ways that he had made calls to the police. So that's what's interesting about this case, but it's also what's frustrating about it.
Leon Jones, the other attorney on the panel, localized the issue of racial bias. He addressed the issue of bias in Northwest Arkansas.
I represent both black men and white men, and I can guarantee you that some of the deals that I've been able to cut for my white clients have been much easier to cut, have been a lot easier to process through than for my black clients, who, not saying that they were charged with the exact same thing, because you can't use that as the litmus test, but just from the process that has happened from the stop, from the initial stop, all the way through the plea or the trial. And so if we look at that on a micro level here in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and then take it to a larger level in New York and Florida and all around the country, we'll see that there is a bias. There is a clear bias, and I deal with it every single day in my practice. And I think one of the issue that I have with it is that when people don't understand their rights, and so a lot of times the reason why that bias really comes out and is really prevalent is because the police understand that certain people don't understand their rights, or certain people don't have an opportunity to go and find out where they can find those rights. And so they just push them through the system just because they can.
Jones also offered an examination of the specifics regarding George Zimmerman's trial. He said the prosecution overreached when they filed second-degree murder charges. That meant they had to prove Zimmerman had what Florida law defines as a depraved mind.
And one of the things that I thought the defense did a great job with and very brilliantly brought out the fact that George Zimmerman didn't have a depraved mind, that it wasn't, he didn't go there that night with the intent to kill not only Trayvon Martin, but anyone. And that he went there, he may have been a little overzealous in what he figured was his job as the neighborhood watch person, but he didn't have that requisite mens rea, as we call it in the law, or that mindset or that mental capacity to kill Trayvon Martin. And I think that's something that you know, we are emotional about the fact that this young black kid was killed, but in seeking justice, we also have to seek justice and not just persecute someone, mm-hmm. but we have to go to prosecute them under the appropriate law.
Last night's conversation also offered appraisals of how the press dealt with the case from start to finish. Corey Anderson, vice president of the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation, said from the beginning there was a racial aspect to the case, from the initial 911 call and beyond.
That it was actually the 911 operator that asked about the race of Trayvon. George Zimmerman didn't, they brought that forward. He didn't actually offer it. They asked him. And they didn't ask him, is he white, black, or Latino? They asked him, is he black or Latino? So even for the 911 officer, there was an assumption there that as George Zimmerman was talking about this person that was walking around this neighborhood, which is a diverse neighborhood, as a suspicious person, even the 911 officer assumed that it was either a black or a Latino person.
And thus, Anderson said he thought from the beginning there was a racial undercurrent in the press coverage, especially the coverage from national cable networks. He told last night's audience he thought the coverage of race in regards to the case was generally mishandled by the press.
Race is an issue that probably requires a scalpel to dissect it. And in general, media is a hatchet. They're using hatchets to do scalpel work. So in the sound bites that we got, whether they be on Fox or on CNN, I think both of them, I don't think either of them served the general public very well.
Patsy Watkins, a professor of journalism at the university, picked up the topic of cable news coverage. Cable channels, she said, are different than their older broadcast counterparts like NBC, CBS, and ABC. That difference, she explained, can have an influence on the style and the amount of coverage given to a certain topic.
Fox News is the leading cable news channel in terms of subscribers and in terms of revenue. Now, why is this? Because they have a very dedicated audience. This is an audience that stays with them all the time. Just as a quick, some quick figures here. During the wall-to-wall coverage of the trial this summer, people watched CNN, people watched Fox News. After the trial, CNN's viewership fell off 43%. Fox News viewership fell off 11%. They've got a dedicated audience.
The majority of that dedicated audience, she said, self-identifies as conservative. Watkins said last night that channel, like other cable channels, had a vested interest in keeping viewers coming back to watch.
Fox News has a very clear Republican conservative line here, and it is in their best interest to keep the audience that they have and to give that audience what that audience expects and wants. That determines the kind of coverage that they have. So they're playing to that side of this political spectrum. CNN has not managed to find a way to create a niche for itself yet. They're somewhat liberal. MSNBC has far outpaced them in being liberal. So they're not really sure where they are yet. So we have a semi-liberal, semi-democratic cable news outlet versus a very diehard Republican outlet. I think that brings it to a political division, a political level.
The entire panel agreed that the coverage and reaction across the board was a stunning example of a country still wrestling with race and involved in a wide political divide. Ron Harris, another panelist participating last night, is the founder and president of the organization A Level Up that helps at-risk youth. He said the coverage of the case merely mimicked what already exists.
Whether it was sloppy reporting on all points, whether the viewership was the same, it was giving edubites of information and leaving the viewer to come to a summary. When you do that, regardless of whether you're CNN or Fox, the person is always going to lead to the next bad thing. If you say the word race, are we going to think good or are we going to think bad? Whether it's CNN or Fox, you're going to always think toward the weeds. That's just my summary as I look at television and not that, but or listen to other mediums. But I think this incident, from a very large standpoint, revealed and just let out of the box how people feel anyway. And so it gave people an opportunity to share and to see and for information to be exposed of what's already there. Mm-hmm. So whether it's a liberal bias or a conservative bias, I think it's always in the interest of those people that are buying information, but it's also the viewership of people, that even the people that are here today. There's an interest, and our responsibility is to really zero in on the specifics, not just the demographics of people, but it's the interest of the general people and the general populace of why people were incensed about race in general.
Much of the final third of the discussion centered on the national dialogue beyond the circumstances surrounding the Trayvon Martin shooting about race. Toward the end, there was this exchange after the moderator, Charles Robinson, asked for comments regarding President Obama's remarks when talking about the Trayvon Martin case. In this exchange, we'll hear from Laurent Sokharov, an assistant professor of law at the University of Arkansas, and Corey Anderson, vice president of the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation.
One quick thing I'll add that now that you're talking about it, that I really liked about his speech was that he not only humanized a black person, but a youth. So he talked about himself as a 17-year-old and how, you know, he would hear the clicks of the doors of people locking their car doors. And it was such a vivid image, but it was like, President Barack Obama was once a 17-year-old, and he wasn't a thug. He was, you know, it's so easy to see him, the tall and lanky and probably really nerdy and studying a lot. And it really made us remember that part of the stereotype and part of the pernicious stereotype isn't just race, it's also youth. Like, we just have this idea of someone of that age being, you know, what they used to call super predators. They finally got rid of that term, but I thought that was really good.
And you all may not invite me back up here, so I'm sorry, but
no, go ahead.
this issue, and I agree with you. What his statement did was he humanized Trayvon. The question, I think, for all of us to grapple with was, why did he have to, right?
Yeah.
Like, why was it necessary for the president, I mean, the leader of the free world, to stand up and say that, to bring this humanity? Because I you're absolutely right. And then, but if you juxtapose it, and again, I think we have to sort of scratch at these things a little bit, but if you juxtapose it, you know, there are certain people that you don't have to humanize. Again, if we're talking about the media, when the young teenage white girl with blonde hair goes missing, it's automatically, everybody feels, including us, right? I mean, including people of all hues and shapes and sizes, we feel and we want to find her and we want to know what happened. And nobody has to take the step to humanize that person. But for a young black man, the president of the United States has to stand up in order for people to move forward and see that. And I think that's really the question, again, that's at the root of, I think, what we're struggling with here.
Did you notice who the last witness of the defense was in the Trayvon Martin case?
I did.
A young blonde woman who had been burglarized, totally unrelated, well, not totally, but in that same area. So that was one of the more racial aspects of the trial. I only say that because it does tie into these paradigms.
And I should say also, you know, we're talking here in broad generalizations, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not to sort of cast aspersions on anybody, but I think if we're going to get underneath, I think, yep. some of this stuff. I think we just have to be just a little bit more transparent.
Last night's panel discussion about the Trayvon Martin case was sponsored by the Center for Multicultural and Diversity Education at the University of Arkansas and was held on the University of Arkansas campus. This is Ozarks at Large.